Kim, across your work, you have focused on the development of empathy, compassion, kindness, resilience, social and emotional competence, and well-being. In your writing on mindfulness and compassion in schools, you argue that education should create context where children's positive human qualities, sympathy, kindness, generosity, compassion can emerge. So I want to begin our conversation by raising these questions. If we are asking what kinds of environments help us, now let me frame that again. Rich, I'm sorry, okay? Yeah. If we want to create the kinds of environments that help young people learn, thrive, and become fully human, what does your research, Kim, suggest are the most important conditions that schools must create?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And I have to say, in reflecting on that question and thinking about the response, I really have to go back to John Dewey, who wrote that the aim of education is the growth of individuals and the development of all their capacities. And I was very fortunate during my master's degree, which I did at U University of Chicago in educational psychology when they still had an education faculty there. My courses were all in the laboratory school at University of Chicago, which is where Dewey started. So I always feel I have to go back to my roots of John Dewey. And also to bring in the ideas that I've, of course, spent the last 4 decades almost, I guess I would say, of my work really focused on this question of how do you create the context. And it was very much inspired, and the questions I have from my work as a teacher. I began as a middle school teacher, teaching 7th and 8th grade French, actually, in Oak Park, Illinois, and then worked for a few years as a teacher at an alternate high school for all of those kids who, for whatever reason, can't manage in the regular school environment. They either get kicked out, they have school failure, they have trouble with the law, often drug and alcohol problems. And it really were those. And then after that, actually, I went and worked at this orthogenic school, Bruno Bettelheim's orthogenic school, which was really based on a therapeutic milieu. And so I brought in all of those experiences that I had been in the field before I went back to graduate school to really help hone what I wanted to focus on. And it was that question, is how to create these contexts. What can we do? And what are the essential ingredients, or what is the recipe, so to speak? And over the years, I do have what I think are the essential ingredients to creating that community. I think, first of all, I really learned this idea of the attention to the physical environment and the human environment, but the physical environment, and so much of when you walk into a place, does it feel a place where their people are valued and listen to? What is it, what's on the walls? And I was so fortunate when I was at University of Chicago, I was able to take a course from Phil Jackson, who wrote a book in 1967 called Life in Classrooms. And Phil, I believe, coined the phrase the hidden curriculum, this idea of the curriculum when you walk into a school, and talked about the physical environment. So if you walk into a high school, for instance, and you see the trophy case on one side and you see the honor roll on the other, it communicates immediately what do we value, who matters, but also who doesn't matter. And that really influenced my work early on of how we create the physical environment to include that belonging. But of course, that's not enough. You could have a really beautiful place that looks belonging, but the relationships aren't that keen. So the second thing to me that is so critical are the teacher-student relationships. The idea that teachers really have to know who kids are and who their students. We did a study. I haven't published it. It was a study we were doing about asking students in high school, what do teachers do to show they care? And we asked kids who were at risk for dropping out. We asked kids who were honor roll kids, and we asked kids who were kind of average. But what they said was, across all groups, the one top of their list, which was fascinating to us and very surprising, they said, the teachers say hi to you in the hallway by your name.
Yes.
And how critical that just that simple thing of saying, I'm seen, I matter, I'm here. So that I just have to say, over the years, really knowing it doesn't take so huge efforts. It could be just noticing kids, just recognizing, noticing. I love the research where teachers who meet greet kids at the door and how they showed really remarkable findings by just standing at the door saying hi to kids as they walked into your classroom. Again, being very present, again, part of the hidden curriculum, because you could be at your desk, you could be a teacher who rushes in at the last minute and starts writing and or sitting at your desk, not even looking up and acknowledging students as they come to the classroom. But that simple acts of kindness are so important. Another ingredient, again, from my experience and then now from my research, is students' agency and autonomy. One of my most, I have to say, one of the most influential experiences I had when I was teaching at the alternate school, where I have to tell you, it was a huge struggle when I began there. These kids, they were not that happy to be in school. They certainly didn't like me as the reading teacher, just, you know, I was the reading teacher, which I was not that popular. And they would say things like, our teacher last year was much better than you, or they wouldn't even acknowledge me, so to speak. And so my feelings were hurt as a teacher. I felt like I wanted my students to like me. I thought I was doing, being a nice person, and they still were not that nice to me. And then I had to reframe my mindset and think, if I had been in school for a number of years and had felt failure, I'd either recognize it might be true or untrue that teachers really didn't care for me, that teachers really didn't acknowledge me, or maybe they said things to me that made me feel stupid. And so my resilience is the armor I put across my heart to support me, so I don't warm up to a new teacher, because it could be I'm going to be brokenhearted again. So I put up this armor. So when I could see that the students, their resilience was putting up that armor, I thought, I just have to, it's going to take my actions. It's not going to just take me feeling that they had to be nice. So one of the most, when I talk about the student agency, the thing that I did is I went there, and we were in a really ugly classroom. Can I just say, it was like an office building. It was nothing on the walls. It was ugly, and it was the, we hardly had any books. I went to them and I said, you guys, I really need help decorating the classroom, but I want your input. What do you want? Like, where would you think the desk should, do we have things on the wall? What do you think? It was unbelievable how giving them that simple in an authentic way, because I truly wanted their help. Like, I didn't have an agenda, how engaged they became, and how they helped pick out posters and rearrange the furniture, and how I had one student, Tim, 6'3", doing his GED, 17, came to me and brought me to the side and said, Kim, those paperback books are always falling down. We had them put up on the counter. They were very well organized. And he said, I work in with my dad on the weekends in a grocery store, and we have one of those turnstile things that you put the paperback books on, you could turn it around. He goes, we have one. I could ask my dad if I could take it for the school. I said, oh, Tim, that would be fantastic. Here is Tim the next day on the short special ed bus, comes in carrying this down the stairs, carrying this huge book rack into the school. And I felt it made such a huge difference to me of how really that agency. And I think for also, I will want to make one comment, is that often things in school would get vandalized. These kids would come in and write on tables. Do you know that once we did that, they helped create that classroom, there was nothing written, nothing torn down, anything. Anyway, so I think that idea of the student autonomy and how we create that environment where we're all, it goes back to Dewey's notion too, really, that idea of engaging kids. And then I have to, you know, I have probably a long list, but I'll just tell you my last thing is the leadership. I'm really convinced in the last decades that it starts with the school leader. And if the principal or whoever that director isn't on board, it's not going to happen. And it really has become crystal clear to me how we need to focus. I've done a lot of work focusing on SEL and teacher preparation. And of course, being a teacher educator for decades in teacher preparation program at University of British Columbia, I don't think we have enough programs for the school leaders when they're becoming master's degrees. And I just feel that school leader, if they support it, it will take place. It's not, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, of course, but I do feel it's essential.
I think, you know, I think all your points are so important. And if I listen to the entirety, you were able, based on your own experiences and insights, to understand that you were experiencing students' resilience when they were in opposition to you and making you feel uncomfortable, that is not where most teachers are positioned or afforded the opportunities to do. And that's where you need a leader who could create conditions where that could happen. Create conditions where students like that young man who is carrying in that case would feel the agency and feel the importance that one has when one creates one's own environment. And I think leadership plays a very important role in enabling those types of opportunities to exist and then to be realized.
Yeah, and it was for me at that school, I do have to say, I don't think I got a lot of support from the leadership. There were some, I think sometimes they were like, you care too much, Kim. You care too much about, I'm like, how can I care too much about my students? Oh my goodness, this is their lives. But at least there's sometimes that sentiment that if you are engaging with the students, if you're doing that. So it is, I have to say, I probably, even though I was like in my early 20s, I was just so young and I just did these things. I don't believe I got enough support to really do as much as I wanted to do.
And I think we know ac across the country and probably world that you can go into every school and at least find some teacher in some place who is doing some of the types of things you're describing. Leadership is about the fact that it isn't that teacher. It's about many teachers, and it happening over and over again. And in part, it's about realizing those opportunities for many students and not just a few who were lucky enough to be in your classroom at that time. So let's go on and let's talk about social emotional learning a little, and also and the fact that some people tend to think about it as an add-on or a program. I'll situate it in a school in Cleveland because during this podcast series, we'll hear a lot about good things going on in Cleveland. And they were. But I remember at one point being in a session in Cleveland where principals were talking about doing the PATHS curriculum. And one principal said, "We do it in our school, and then we get down to the work." And I was so happy that people from district leadership were there to hear that, because as your smile would indicate, that's part of the challenge. So, is SEL an add-on, or is it something that must be fundamental?
Of course, you'll know my answer. It's not an add-on. I like the quote. I don't know who came up with it, but I'm going to use it here. Social and emotional learning is not another thing on the plate, your plate. It is the plate. It's foundational. And I actually will go back to the notion of the hidden curriculum that I mentioned earlier with Phil Jackson. Phil wrote a book called The Moral Life of Moral Life in Schools, or the yeah, something the Moral Life in Schools, and from in 1991, I believe. And what he did is they went and observed what happens in schools. And I learned so much because essentially what happens is teachers every day are teaching social and emotional learning, whether they know it or not. How do you respond to stress? How do you respond to how do you start your classroom? How do you respond to a student's comment? How do you deal with bullying in your classroom? Through any action, you are actually modeling, teaching social emotional learning skills. It could be bad. You could be doing really teaching really bad skills, but you're still, your emotions are there. You're part of the social situation. I always argue we're teaching them anyway. Why not do them more intentionally explicit and based on the science? So that's one thing I often say that you can't devoid learning from social and emotional. We know, of course, from Mary Helen Imerdonu Yang's work that you, it was in another podcast, the intersection that cognition and emotion are in integrally linked. How you feel affects how you learn. So social emotional learning has got to be part of everything. It has to be in the I always say in the doors and the floors and the pores, it has to be ever embedded within every aspect. When I talk about the definition of social and emotional learning, we often, and this still, I think it still goes right to programs. And I think it's because when the field was beginning, they really wanted to have the scientific basis, and they went to programs and having the program Castle program guide and all the programs. And I think that really has stuck, and people haven't expanded as much. There are many, of course, about a systemic approach. And sometimes a systemic approach can become quite complicated. But I've tried to make it very simple. When I talk about the essential ingredients of SEL and what SEL is, there's three ingredients. Number one, of course, there's the SEL of the students. And it could be through student agency, integrating social emotional learning into academic curriculum. I was a language arts teacher. I could tell you I was doing SEL. In fact, oh, it's so fascinating. I just went through my lesson plans from when I was an undergraduate at Illinois State University and found one of my lesson plan units for social studies, which was developing interpersonal and intrapersonal understanding. This was in 1979. Anyway, so it goes back a long time. So the integration into academics, student agency, and then specific skill development. You mentioned I do work on mindfulness, giving students opportunities to learn ways to manage their stress and why, what happens in their brain when they do that, teaching specific skills as it's perspective taking and doing that. So I think for kids, that's the students, that's the three things. For teachers, this is so the other dimension, there's SEL of the students, SEL of the of the adults. So of the educators, there are their own well-being, their own social emotional competencies, all are integral to how they teach the students, how they are in the social situation. And the last one is the context, is the sort of creating the caring school environment, having positive parent school relationships, the school leader, classroom climate, discipline approaches. Like that should be integral. Like how we deal with discipline, how is that integrated? Many other kinds of aspects in terms of that. But if you think of those three dimensions, the SEL of the students, the SEL of educators, and the learning context, then you get the full picture of why SEL has to be seen as a foundation to learning and and again, going back to the aim of education, is not just about the learning. And I realize people still see the academics as a primary outlet, but really it's about human development, that we want to develop humans who are going to flourish and thrive and be participating members in our society.
And what I hear you talking about is an ecosystem that creates an ecology that is an ecology that has all these different components that contribute to learning, but really contribute to development and contribute to humanizing people.
Yes, exactly. And I feel that we now have such great science that shows that things like children's pro-social skills, how much they help, share, cooperate, those are better predictors of academic grades than standardized test scores. And in fact, there's that one great study. It wasn't mine, but the study by Jones, Crowley, and Greenberg that looked at followed children from kindergarten, and they looked at their social emotional competencies and their pro-social skills, particularly like how much they shared, helped, cooperated, and followed them into their 20s. And they found that those students in kindergarten who had those pro-social skills were more taken into account socioeconomic status and aggression and all those things. Those students with the high pro-social skills in kindergarten were more likely to graduate from high school, earn a post-secondary degree, and find stable employment. Just from the social emotional skills. So you can't say their academic achievement is going to predict all those things. We now know that it's those skills that predict success in school and in life.
And those skills, as you're describing, are not just the self-regulation that the famous marshmallow studies got, which is not unimportant, but the marshmallow studies were affected by people's responses to who was offering the marshmallows. And for those listening, the children were told that if they delayed eating a marshmallow, in the end, they would have the opportunity to have two marshmallows. And for many years, people said, look, the kids who didn't have the marshmallows and waited succeeded. We now know that you can prime young people to trust or untrust teachers. And then they know that some teachers may say, wait, and there'll be two marshmallows, and other teachers will forget that there were two marshmallows. Whereas what you're describing, if I hear in terms of the study, is really one that was not dependent on the teachers, but really looking at how the young people were behaving with each other.
Yeah, and I think the pro. So it's interesting you raised that. There's two things that are really important in your statement, in your explanation. One is this idea that we often focus. It's interesting. A lot of programs really focus a lot on the self-regulation. I have to say, there's a lot of SEL programs that focus a lot on getting that self-regulation, which of course we know is so critical. The Michelle et al. Study, and then you're alluding to the Kidd et al. Study, which showed that it depended on whether or not you trusted the adult to follow through. And of course, there's work on socioeconomic status. But I think a lot of people fall short and focus on the self-regulation, but don't focus on the ideas like pro-social, like caring for others, being kind. And that's my heart, where my heart is. And I think the other dimension is also this idea that what predicts your life success, and the idea that, yes, these aspects can predict life success, but we know so much now about how these pro-social skills. But I don't think it's an interesting thing, and it really is. We focus on the pro-social skills. I believe that it all depends on the classroom context. If you're in a classroom, and I'll just tell you, I'll give you an example from me again. So I really love volunteering, generosity, getting kids engaged in activities that benefit others. That's, if you have to say, I started that way long time ago. I had a in my alternative school that I was teaching these high school students who, if you saw them on one side of the block, you might actually change, walk on the other side of the block because they could look scary. This is back in the day. They had tattoos before tattoos became fashionable. They had all of that. I decided that we would collect Toys for Tots at Christmas time. Toys for Tots is an, I think it's a national thing. You collect the toys and you donate them to needy kids. I go to the other teachers and they're like, these kids will never donate anything. They're going to steal the stuff. Don't bring it in. Don't do this. And sometimes people don't realize I'm actually a real rebel. And so I was like, I'm going to do it anyway. So I came in and I had a big box I decorated with wrapping paper and put it. I just have to say one thing, and this was 1981. The kids were allowed to smoke in schools. People might remember this, but whatever. We had a big smoke eater that ate the smoke. It didn't really work, but whatever. I put the Toys for Tots box. But I came in and told the kids, you guys, we're going to do, I want to know if you're interested in helping collect toys for kids. And I had this story of, I said, you can imagine some children who might wake up Christmas morning not having any presents for them, or kids. And all of them, and I related, and all of them could think about times that they had felt deprived or vulnerable or things. And it was fascinating how many of these kids start bringing in toys. Some of them initially go, yeah, you told my mom, and so she told me to bring this in. And then they started bringing them in. And then in the end, we all went together to bring the toys. Anyway, so the point is really that the teacher creates the conditions for that pro-social behavior. Those kids probably never would have thought about donating. I'd like to think that after that happened, that they would think in the future of being able to donate and volunteer and give back. So anyway, so yeah, I just want to be clear that pro, I don't believe pro, I think it's the context that the teacher creates.
You've been really busy for a while. I said, I'm going to take my walk now. Okay, for now, I'll go spend our time.
Okay, fine.
It'll be a little while away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. I'm sorry, Rich. Okay. I think you are very right about the fact that while there are the human potentiality to be pro-social, it unfolds within environments that support the pro-sociality, and that includes teachers creating those conditions. I think we have a whole body of research that suggests that while peer relations are so important, teachers play a very, very key role that they often are unaware of in creating those peer environments and priming them in different ways.
Yes, and I think it's such an important, we don't talk enough about the peer context in classrooms. I think we focus so much on the notion of it's a teacher-student relationships, but really that peer relationships and anybody who is even starting in kindergarten, but anybody who worked in middle, I worked in middle school, oh my goodness, if you're not a cognizant of the peer ecology, you're out. And so a couple of things I want to raise. So of course, in my research, it's been fascinating. One of the things I really look at when I evaluate social and emotional learning programs like MindUp and the Roots of Empathy, and I have another study on this well-being curriculum, is we often collect data on the peer ecology. We actually have students rate each other on how much they like to be in school activities with, oh, the one study on kindness counts. And we ask kids to, because if you want to know how kids treat each other, you have to ask the kids. Don't ask the teachers. The kids know so much. And what we find remarkably across every single study I've done, and it's not just me, is that the peer group, if you do an SEL program, you see actually increases in how kids see each other as helpful and caring and cooperative. The control group, every time, I can tell you, every study I have done that has looked from kindergarten to sixth or seventh or eighth grade, is that the classroom across the school year, the peer group gets worsens. Kids are less trusting of each other. They're less likely to help one another. They're less likely to be kind because what we know from the science, and I'll bring in social psychology. My husband Arlie, you know David, is a social psychologist, is that these in-groups and out-groups form. It's you put any group of people together, it happens. It's part of the hierarchy. It happens in primates. It happens. And Tom Boyce, a good friend and colleague of mine, has studied the peer ecologies with kindergartners and said a peer hierarchy, actually, through his observations in one study, within the first 2 weeks of school, you know already which kids are at the top, which kids are at the bottom, who are the in-group, who are the out-group, and things. And but as a teacher, I have to say, did I, in my teacher preparation, did I ever get trained or educated in how peer ecologies happen and what you could do to disrupt that natural tendency? And so I've spent a lot of time thinking through that. As a teacher, you have to be aware of when you, and I go back to the work, it's actually of Erwin Staub. I don't know if you know of Erwin Staub's work on cultures of violence, cultures of peace, and that he says when you engage them together in activities that benefit others, it creates a pro-social value orientation together. Even though unbeknownst to the research, when I did this activity where I had the kids come in and donate toys for tots, that I actually, by them working together to benefit others, was creating this more positive peer culture. And the thing that educators have to know is it has to be intentional. It doesn't, if you leave it to your own devices, it actually goes up, well, for the most part, but goes the opposite direction. The in-groups and the out-groups and the bullying and the exclusion and all of those things that happen. But how intentionally, when you work together to create, again, even creating that a classroom where we work together to say, how do we all want people to be? I think of even Mark Brackett's work on RULER, how do we want to feel and how do we create this class charter together? Those activities have to be intentional and to create that and to revisit it and say, how are things going? What can we do to have a place where everyone feels they belong?
One of my all-time favorite Edutopia videos is this video from Anchorage that is now about tw at least 20 years old of teaching math as a social activity.
I love that. I show it all the time, David,
I
you should
see.
know. Yeah, I taught Bowman Elementary School. I totally know that one.
And I think so. Tell the audience why that really embodies what we're talking about.
It's so beautiful. It's and the teacher, I wish I remembered his name. He has so many different things. It was Bowman Elementary, and he already starts about as math as a social, really it's SEL, but he shows and he does two things. One is he creates this opportunity for students to work in groups together to solve problems. I think they're working with some, what do they call them? The sort of math activities where they have little pieces to solve problems. And so he gets them to work together and they each have a role and then they share it. There's a fishbowl where the kids stand out around them, and the other kids are talking about their receiving process. So everybody is reflecting on one another. But you know what he doesn't do, and I just have to say, is all the stuff it takes to create that safety among the students to be able to express their thinking out loud, to not acknowledge their mistakes. And I think, anyway, so it's a beautiful example. I don't know if you could give a link to
I think
the
we
video.
will. Yes. You know that I so much loved that and talked about people that once time when I was doing a site visit in Anchorage, at the end of it, people said, David, we have a surprise for you. And then they opened the door and this rock star, that teacher came in. I was so thrilled because he really does embody what many teachers are able to do again when they're afforded that opportunity. And if I remember correctly, that was a responsive classroom school or class. And I think that's an example of a program that is more than a curriculum that
Yeah, I agree. Responsive classroom, caring school community, those programs that are not once a lesson, they're just, it's really just good teaching, good pedagogy of how you acknowledge students and how learning takes place. It's a beautiful example, but it really, what I love, what you're raising, surfacing here is the importance of the peer ecology, that kids are all together. It brings to one study that's one of my favorites by Kathy Wenzel. Kathy Wenzel has written so much amazing research over the past couple of decades, few decades now, on looking at students' peer relationships. But she wrote a study in 1990, wrote a paper in 1993 in a Journal of Educational Psychology. I love it, called "Does Being Good Make the Grade?" And she actually looked at middle schoolers, and she did things like she looked at their pro-social behavior, but how she looked at it was the same way I'd said I've measured it, where you give kids a roster of the kids, circle all the names of your classmates who share, circle all the names who help, who cooperate, and help other kids when they have a problem. And what she found was fascinating. She found that pro-social behavior, measured by how kids treat each other, was a better predictor of their academic grades than were standardized achievement test scores. And what she talks about, what really is happening there, at least her view of interpreting her findings, is that when you create this sort of model or this value orientation of we are in this together, we're here all to help each other learn. It isn't just a one-way street or teacher to student. We're all together. Teachers are learning from the students are learning from one another. And she believes that the pro-social behavior was went to learning. So if the teacher is saying about a math assignment, and I go, oh, I can hear the whole things. And I go to my classmate and go, what did the teacher say? They tell you right away, or saying, I'm having trouble with this English. And that someone comes over and says, oh, I'll sit with you and help you with it. It's the pro-social behavior among the classmates that really help learning happen.
And I don't know if this will fit in, Rich. So I'll put it in this way, only because it's right, but it's for the time. One of the reasons why, in conceptualizing the conditions for learning, to me, peer and adult social and emotional competency is so important. It's not just adult, it's for the reasons you're talking about, that what is happening in the school, what is happening in the classroom is not just the product of a student and their competencies and a teacher and their competence, but all those ongoing interactions and coactions that are taking place every moment within the classroom that's supporting both learning and well-being.
Yes, I agree. And it's synergistic, really, in the sense of how you bring these students and teachers together. One thing I haven't really surfaced, and I really want to, how teachers, and I think this is one of the things that really helped me a lot early on. And I have no idea how I learned it. I just have to say, is that when I went into my classroom, I was there to learn from my students as much as I was there to teach them. And how, when I had that mindset of, and I'll tell you this perfect example. It's I went into class one day. I was teaching seventh, eighth grade French. I think it was my eighth graders. And they had to study for an exam. I was there just for a short time. I was there for one semester, a teacher taking a maternity leave. And they had to study for this exam. We just in the chapter, it was like you do the exam at the end. Back there, you had the mimeograph, all that kind of stuff. And I really was stuck because I was, so I think I get bored easily. I need to have new, exciting things always happening. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I just, that creative spirit. I went to them and I said, we could study, what do you usually do when you study for an exam? They said, we write the words in sentences. I'm like, okay. Can we try? Let's brainstorm something a different way that you could really learn these words in French that are going to be on your exam next week. And they were, the unit was on food. It was like on food and restaurants or something. And I went to them, and of course they go to France. They were so cute. They were like, they're at that age, they're just so creative and they come up with fun things. But they ended up in the end, not me, coming up and saying, let's have a French cafe day on Friday. Of course, then they said, we can make menus and we can use all of our vocabulary words. And then of course, someone else says, but we should have real food. We shouldn't just pretend. And I'm like, okay, they came up with it. And so they even came after school to work on the menus. They were so into it. If seventh and eighth graders are really keen on that. Last the Friday, they come and get the classroom keys. I don't know if I could even still do that now. I gave them the keys to get in the classroom. I was in the lunchroom. I come down the hallway. There's a long line up outside my classroom. I'm like, oh God, that maybe the key didn't work, but why are they lined up? I go there. There's one of the students. They're so cute. Oh my God. Had the towel over his, like he was the maitre d', the towel. They had organized the classroom into these little cafe tables. They had decided who's the servers, who's the customers. They spoke French. They used their words. We laughed. We ate. I remember I brought in some food. They brought in some food. And they all aced their exam. After that moment, and it was, I don't even know, it wasn't like I did it intentionally. I just kind of came up with it. Whenever I was organizing assignments, I went to them. You guys, what do you think is the best way for you to learn about this? What can we do? What can we do to make it fun? And so that, anyway, so we don't talk enough about teachers learning from their students. And I think a lot of teachers do it already, but it's part to me of SEL. That's my sense.
And again, I th there is this human ecology that can embody very powerful SEL. And it is where the teacher's curiosity and needs is being addressed by the students at the same time that she is addressing their needs. And it doesn't always happen. A lot of things need to be in place to enable it, just as there had to be preconditions for the day that was filmed in that Alaska classroom. But at the same time, if the preconditions have existed, then when you ask the students, what are your ideas, and they come up with the idea, you're ready for the next steps.
Yeah, and I think I have to say I was very keen and I had fun with the students. I have to say, here's someone who went from teaching seventh and eighth grade to an alternate school to working in a residential treatment center. I like the challenges, but I think that I was able to not be, oh, sorry. One of the challenges that happens sometimes is teachers come in with a preconceived mindset of how students that age will behave and how you have to have more control over them. And this really, Jackie Eckel's work on developmental stage environment mismatch, really, if we, instead of seeing these young adolescents as like they're ruled by their hormones, and if don't give them any control because they'll take over, they'll run everything. But I didn't have that mindset. I just loved being with them and they were funny. And of course, they were quirky and they could be a bit raucous sometimes, certainly, but I didn't bother me. But, anyways, I think that it's a really critical point for teachers teaching young people of that mindset and to think about the stereotypes they do have. And of course, there's research showing there's really, especially as kids move into adolescence, the stereotypes you have of how we can really see of course, the positive youth development research really brings up a lot of the more positive things. But anyways, I do think it's a critical part of education.
This has been a great conversation.